What I was kind of inspired to talk about today is a very basic aspect of Vipassana practice, mindfulness practice, that some people do and some people don't. It's optional. But it's the way it was taught, this particular system that I teach, the way it was taught in Asia, this was a very important element of it. And that is the practice, the technique of mental noting. And the other day I was with, my son was acting out a little bit. And I think I told him he couldn't do something. And he went to his room and he has this little toy balsa sword that he was given at school recently. And it's kind of like his first weapon. And it was a big deal. All the kids made them. And they were supposed to fight dragons at school. And I think maybe it was sword, I guess. And so he had this at home. And so I kind of had my back to him when he came out. So I didn't quite see it. My wife saw it. But he was actually coming out and kind of like, you know, trying to stab me kind of from 6 feet away. And he was pretty angry. But it was clear to me that he was, you know, upset about something. And I didn't want to... So what I wanted to do was I wanted to name it for him. I wanted to kind of label it, name, kind of do a mental note out loud for my son. Just kind of name what he was feeling. But I figured he was angry, but I wasn't sure. So I didn't want to kind of impose my idea on him in case that was not the right thing. So I tried a couple. And what I said, oh, are you angry or are you sad? And I had this idea that simply, I didn't really care so much about whether he, you know, answered me or not, but I had this idea that just simply naming it, putting the name out into the atmosphere, into the environment, would help him recognize or cope with how he was feeling. Feel like he was recognized and understood or seen in some way, acknowledged, and that it would be easier for him to put it down or to have a more healthy relationship to it or something. And my tone of my voice was very matter-of-fact, you know, are you angry or are you sad? I wasn't upset that he was directing it towards me. And so I don't really know the consequences of having done this with him. I mean, he did quiet down, calm down very quickly. But he might have anyway, I don't know. But what I was doing, in a sense, was practicing for him the practice of mental noting. So that's with child raising. I wanted to read you some little descriptions of some clinical efforts to bring mindfulness practice, the person who learned Vipassana practice, the techniques of it, and try to apply it in a kind of clinical psychological setting. So this had to do, first one had to do with a case of a divorced woman who would have bouts of depression and anxiety when she remembered her ex-husband's bizarre sexual demands. She was trained to label her thoughts as remembering. And within a few days, she could see the causal relationship between the thoughts and the anxiety and depression. Quite something. So she was using the practice of mental noting. Noting what was happening. Remembering. Then another woman who was hospitalized for manic depression and schizophrenia was instructed to watch the second hand of a clock. And when her mind went off the clock, to name the distraction. Soon she realized that most of her distractions were related to the past. She was then instructed to label them as remembering. With this technique, she learned to identify herself with the objective watcher of her disturbing thoughts instead of the depressed thinker. So here's someone. So we do this kind of similar thing, you know. One of the basic practices we have is to stay with the breath, follow the breath, be with the breath. And then you don't stay with the breath, right? You're not so obedient, apparently. And the mind wanders off. And then we notice, we recognize, oh, thinking, planning, remembering, you know, we kind of name recognizing where the mind goes. And that recognition is very powerful. And to start recognizing the patterns and then to be able to have a way of naming it and labeling it, it helps a lot to disengage ourselves from that magnetic pull or magnetic attraction or that grip that seems to exist sometimes between our mind and the kind of thoughts that we have. And that's one of the functions of mindfulness and one of the functions of mental noting, is to help loosen up that grip, There are other ways maybe you can get this loosened up, but that's one of the ways. So one more case study. Oh, I didn't finish this one. So with this technique, she learned to identify herself with the objective watcher of her disturbing thoughts instead of the depressed thinker. Soon, she began to gain insight into the nature of her illness and was released from the hospital. Another woman who was hospitalized for anxiety, depression, and inability to function adequately rebelled against any suggestion of introspection. As she was a Mormon, the word Buddhist or meditation was not mentioned. As the therapist interacted with her, it became evident that much of her day was spent fantasizing and imagining to avoid the anxiety of her life. The habit of fantasizing was discussed with her, and then she was asked to undertake a psychological procedure. To her surprise, she was asked to bake a cake. However, she had to do it extremely mindfully with minute attention to detail. When the persistent fantasies would arise, she was instructed to just observe them. After a while, she found that she could intentionally return to the present moment and so function more adequately. She also began to gain insight into the nature of her anxiety and depression. Well, that example is not about mental noting per se, but so mental noting is a very simple technique where it augments and supports mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice doesn't require having a mental note. But mental noting is a very simple practice of naming your experience that you're paying attention to. So if you're with your breathing, for example, you would name it perhaps in for the in-breath, out for the out-breath. Or the classic one that I was taught in Asia was rising, falling, because we were instructed to pay attention to the rising, falling of the abdomen. So rising, falling. And I probably said rising, falling over and over again more than most people in, you know, in America. Rising, falling. And but in, out. So some kind of label that kind of names it. And then if there's an emotion, happiness, you know, name it. Happiness, happiness. Or sadness, sadness. Kind of name it. Or if there's physical pain, pain, pain. Or if there's physical joy, you might name it as pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. If there's outside sounds, hearing, hearing, just thinking, thinking, thinking. And now some people, when they hear about this, rebel. They don't like it. They don't like this idea of using mental notes, especially if they've been involved in other forms of meditation practice for a long time before, because the association they have, it seems like their mind is getting busy. They're doing all this stuff with their mind. They're trying to quiet their mind. They've gotten used to the mind being quiet. It seems like now you're agitating the mind by having this mental noting going on. And it can be that way. But it's kind of like learning to ride a bicycle. I don't remember so well, you know, how it was for me. But I imagine when I first started riding a bicycle, I was, you know, probably not so calm. It was kind of, you know, agitating activity. You know, it was kind of like my body was jerking all over the place. But eventually I've learned to ride a bicycle. And now I can ride a bicycle without thinking about it. And, you know, even without using my hands. So, you know, it's gotten very easy now. It's second nature to ride a bicycle. Same way with the mental noting. It can be initially kind of agitating and disturbing even to do it because it seems like you're making yourself busy. But after a while, it becomes kind of second nature and becomes very easy. And the disadvantages of doing it disappear, and what remains are the advantages of doing it. So some of the advantages are that it helps keep you on track. And, you know, with being mindful, if you keep going a regular rhythm of mental noting, very easy going, doesn't have to be fast or hurried, but just kind of in the moment, just what's happening now? Just hearing, stretching, itching, itching, hearing, breathing in, itching, smiling. Well, not yet. You want me to scratch? And the advantage of that is that it keeps you on track in paying attention to what's happening in the present moment. And sometimes I don't do the mental noting, and sometimes I do it. It kind of varies with my practice over time. But sometimes I do it just as a kind of a test to see, am I fooling myself, how present I actually am? Because I'm capable of fooling myself. I think I'm kind of present here. You know, things are going pretty well. But really, my mind is kind of present. But really, I'm mostly lost in my thoughts or caught up in my thoughts thinking about something. And by having the mental noting, you know, if I keep doing it in a steady way, I have this reference, like these people in the clinical studies. I have this reference that helps notice when I get lost in my thought, I stop noting. So that's why it's a reference, a very powerful one for me. So if I keep the steady rhythm going, then I can kind of get a sense of overall how my practice is going. Am I slipping off a lot? Am I forgetting to do it a lot? It also helps keep me on track. It's kind of a little nudge, a little reminder. Stay present, stay present, stay present. Wasn't there a book by Aldous Huxley? Some island book, some place where they live, was it?
Island. Pay attention.
There's a parrot, a bird said pay attention all the time. Wouldn't it be great if we had little birds and pay attention, you know, instead of car alarms and horns and all that. Or we have this, you know, I have this car that, now finally, I don't feel lonely anymore because finally I have this car that speaks to me. You know, I used to be kind of, you know, all the other people had cars that spoke to them, and I didn't have, you know, my car didn't speak. But now it speaks, but it doesn't speak very well. It just goes beep, beep. And it could say, you know, pay attention. You know, and as a reminder. But anyway, keeping me on track, I find it very helpful that mental noting is a reminder to stay on track, stay with what's going on. It also encourages me to stay focused a little bit more fully. When I use the mental noting, it's like a little nudge or encouragement to really be present for what I'm paying attention to. And sometimes I can be kind of complacent with my practice. I can kind of know what's going on. I can kind of, I'm feeling a pain, or I kind of, well, that's an in-breath. I've known a lot of those, thank you. And, you know, I can kind of be there with an in-breath. But the mental noting, when I say in or say rising or something, note, you know, it's kind of an encouragement. It's kind of a habit now because I've done it so much. Okay, let's really be here for it. Let's pay careful attention. Kind of be engaged to connect with the experience. At the same time, part of the function of mental noting is to separate me from the experience. So it's kind of paradox to talk this way, but on one hand, it helps me connect, see it more fully, be there for it, in a sense. At the same time, not to be entangled with it, not to be lost in my thought about it, my self-pity with it, or my all the different kind of judgments and the things that can go on about the experience. So here in the clinical studies, they talk about having objective watcher. But kind of having that sense of awareness, that sense of presence, which is independent from what you're experiencing. You don't have to posit a watcher, just a sense of presence that's independent. And that's, for me, one of the advantages of mental noting. It strengthens that part of my psyche where I can be present but independent of what's happening. Not aloof, because I also connect at the same time. Not aloof, but free of being entangled, free of grasping, free of trying to run away and pull away from. Kind of a very balanced independence. And a lot of what Dharma practice is trying to find us, provide us, is a certain kind of independence, independent awareness that is independent of what it's aware of. But not aloof, not distant, not disassociated. But at the same time, kind of very present, very honest, what's going on. So I notice for myself as I do the mental noting that over time it tends to strengthen that independent presence, because part of the part of my mind, part of the way it works is that part of my mind which is noting belongs to that part of my mind which is independent, not connected, not entangled. So that part gets stronger, and I can find over sitting that part of the independent radiance of the mind gets stronger and stronger. And I take up, in a sense, residence in that independent radiance of the mind. I find a refuge there. I find my freedom there. I find a much more satisfying place to be than the things I'm worried about or caught up in. It kind of helps me disengage with my worry, my fears, my plannings, my memories, all the things that my mind kind of might get otherwise sucked into, and kind of like Velcro, you know, Velcro mind. Do you ever feel like you have Velcro mind? the thoughts just kind of stick. So, also, another function of mental noting is that there seems to be some value in the psyche of clearly naming what your experience is, especially kind of your emotional experience or your psychological experience. The old story of naming the dragon loses its power. Or when I was in Northern Africa, there were people there who had this idea. You don't tell anybody really what your birth name is, because you have another name that people know you by. Because your birth name, there's power associated with that. And if they know your birth name, they have some power over you. It's kind of like a secret. So there's some traditional idea that there's power in naming. And I've seen it in my psychological life that if I can name with relatively accuracy what an experience is, my psychological experience, sometimes it's the accuracy of the naming which helps me become free of it. And, I've seen it with a number of things. I've seen it with anger. I've seen it with depression. I remember once, I've told this story, but once feeling kind of crummy and hanging out with that and being with it, being mindful of my body, feeling the crumminess. And then, but it wasn't until I kind of recognized that they named it as depression that the depression lifted. There was something very powerful about naming the experience. Some people have a very, very small vocabulary for naming their emotional life or different aspects of their life. It can be very helpful to expand that vocabulary. Learn a bigger range of words for anger. We have, there's a lot of different words, in English that are kind of belong to the category of anger. All the way from, annoyance and irritation to rage and fury. So, you can kind of learn all this subtle differences. We can probably sit here together as a group and come up with maybe, I wouldn't be surprised if 25 different words, all relating to anger and have shades of difference in meaning. The more accurately you can name, the greater it is in helping the mind become independent and free. Now, naming, how you do the noting, is very important. It's an art. I think of noting as an art form rather than so much as a technique. So as an art form, you have to kind of learn and vary how you do the noting over time and learn different ways of doing it. One way is to do it just constantly for everything that you pay attention to, everything you bring mindfulness to. I know some people who prefer to only do certain categories of their experience. The only thing they note is their thoughts, when the thoughts really need attention. Thinking, planning, remembering, whatever. Some people I know who only label their emotions. And probably different people choose different areas of their life because that's the areas where it's most helpful to somehow use a noting to disentangle them from being enmeshed and caught up in these experiences. The way in which the mental noting is said, I usually say, do it as a quiet whisper in the mind. Try to make it very soft, very gentle. Kind of, I like to say, if you have any sense of where the quietest level of thinking is in your mind, do the notes from that place. If you go out and rob a bank and sit down, probably your mind is thinking your mind is very agitated and strong and powerful. But if you've had this, wonderful nap and rested and everything's going perfect in your life and you sit down and you've been meditating for a while already all day and you come down to sit and your mind is very soft and calm and, there's a very quiet, subtle kind of thinking maybe you're aware of kind of deep down underneath, very soft and gentle. If you do have a sense of different levels of thinking, try to make the mental noting from the softest place available to you. I found that as I meditate and my meditation gets more and more concentrated, I get more subtle in my meditation, then at some point, the way in which I'm saying the mental noting becomes coarser than the state of my mind. And then it feels a little bit irritating to do something coarser than the subtlety of the mind. And so then I have to soften the mental noting to correspond with the subtlety of the mind. And if I'm on a retreat, then I notice sometimes that, you know, there's a number of different steps like that. The mind gets quieter, I soften the mental noting. The mind gets quieter, I soften the mental noting, like that. Softer and softer. The mental noting is also interesting. It's also interesting to pay attention to the quality of the voice that's doing the mental noting. What I mean is, if you're sitting here and you have physical pain, and you say to yourself, you listen to how you're doing the mental noting of pain, and it goes something like this. Pain! That's a good indication of your relationship to the pain. You're not neutral, you're not, you know, you're kind of caught up in it and, you know, full of self-pity or whatever, aversion. If you're sitting here and you're feeling, you know, delight, joy, physical joy, you know, and you go, oh, joy. That's another sign that you're caught up. You're somehow indulging, you're caught by it. The mental noting should be very simple, a matter of fact. Pain, pain, joy, joy. Not that joy is bad or not to be had. Not that you're not allowed to feel the enjoyment of it. But you don't want to be entangled with it. It's so much more precious. It's so much more wonderful than any joy you can experience, physical joy. The joy of having an independent mind, the mind that's luminous, independent, the heart that's that way. So paying attention to the quality of the voice can be very helpful. Some people then struggle about how they make mental notes, thinking they have to find the right note. Even though I said that earlier, it's useful to find, you know, be more exact. You don't want to struggle in meditation with finding a note. You want to do that which is most obvious. And if what's most obvious is to just say, I'm having an experience right now, just as a way of kind of framing or encouraging your mind to pay attention to what's happening now. You know, feeling crummy. That's not very exact, right? Just, I'm feeling crummy. I'm feeling off. Just something that kind of encourages you to pay more attention to what this experience is, to be more present for it, and perhaps not so caught up in it. I sometimes, in mental noting, I've told this before, I guess recently, but sometimes I use the mental noting of yes to my experience. Whatever it is, yes, yes, yes. And that's occasionally, it's very powerful for me to do. Just yes, yes, yes. Kind of an acknowledgement, an acceptance of what's there. I've never tried no, no, no. Maybe I should try that. It is a kind of spiritual technique of just nada, 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 neti, neti. Just no, no, no to whatever's going on. The Zen koan mu. One way of doing mu is the Zen koan mu kind of means no in Chinese or Japanese. And I don't know if I will. Why am I telling you this? The koan is, does a dog have Buddha nature? And you're given the answer, and the answer is mu. And then, so that's the koan. You have to somehow grapple with that koan, and come back to the teacher with an answer. And so, what's that about? Does a dog have Buddha nature? Moo. And that sounds like a cow. But one of the ways of understanding the practice of mu, it's very in Rinzai Zen. It's one of the primary practices, and one of the ways of doing the mu koan is mu means no. But is to use it as a no. Just whatever arises in experience, not settling for it, not picking it up, not being engaged in it. No, no, no. Moo, moo, moo. Encouraging the mind to stay independent, not caught by anything. There are other ways of practicing the mu koan. Anyway, sometimes I say yes. Other times, when my mind gets very quiet and very subtle, and not a lot of thoughts are going on, sometimes I just kind of like make the mental note, whatever's going on, And I find it still useful to do that, even if it's so subtle, this little, little grunt. That little grunt kind of just keeps me on track. And it feels, again, it's one of the lovely experiences to feel, like you're really on track, you're on the groove with the mindfulness, you're really present, you're riding the present, you're not wavering, you're kind of like in a little, you're kind of, you know, you're in a groove with it. And to have that groove kind of being fueled and fed a little bit, and you really feel like you're riding, like it's like surfing on a wave. You've caught the wave. Like you've caught the present moment, and you're kind of riding the present moment. You're really there. And it doesn't feel like work anymore. It's like, you know, it's almost impossible to leave. Or, you know, it's like, you just need a little bit of encouragement to stay on that wave. And that mental noting, little can be that encouragement. Be on the groove, to be on the wave. And you can kind of ride that wave for a long time. Though sometimes, you know, I saw this photograph in one of the local taquerias of this 16-year-old who caught a 40-foot wave at Maverick over there on Stinson Beach. And he's beautiful. He sees him, you know. There's four series of photographs, and he's beautiful. The 16-year-old is up, catching the wave. The surfboard flips at 40 feet up. And he lives to talk about it. And so next to the photograph, there's a description of what it was like and how he hit bottom, ocean bottom, when the wave pushed him down, 25 feet down. And then he had to swim up as fast as he could to get in the air, and came to the surface and took one big gulp of breath until he had to dive under because the next 40-foot wave came. Why am I telling you this? What? Riding the wave. Well, sometimes we fall in. Also, there is a reason to tell you this. So sometimes we fall in, right? We kind of lose the present moment. And then he writes in his little description, he says, or the person writing the description of it says that then he went out further past the waves again and got in line. And that day he caught 8 more waves. And when he asked, why after this big accident, you know, why did you go back? And he said, I knew that if I didn't go back out again, I would never ride a wave again. So remember that when you lose the present moment, just come right back. Don't be dissuaded. Don't lose heart. Don't get discouraged. Just get back on that wave. Learn to surf. I wanted to. Oh, so I know that in Buddhist circles and kind of New Age circles, and our whatever, there's sometimes a distrust of words. And, you know, the word label, you know, if you label something, you know, label, the word is not the experience. Words are incapable of really explaining or describing an experience, what's really going on. And the real spirituality points to something which is ineffable, which is undescribable, and words just fail. And there's maybe truth to this. I don't want to argue against this. But in Zen, they have the expression that a word can kill and a word can give life. That if we only understand how words can keep us at a distance from reality by judging it or some kind of vague concept, then we're shortchanging ourselves understanding how words also give life. And our life would be much poorer if we didn't have words. So one of the most dramatic examples of this this is what I'm trying to say here, I think is from Helen Keller's book. And she writes, do you all know Helen Keller? You can't know her. Everybody know her? Maybe some people are not from America. So Helen Keller was deaf and dumb. And was he blind too? Yes. Deaf, dumb, and blind, right? So how's she going to learn to speak? How's she going to learn how to communicate? And so amazingly, at some point as a teenager or a kid, she had this teacher who was convinced to try to find some way to establish language with this girl and get her. And eventually she became quite a big, you know, she's very, very, was a very bright and very smart, very bright woman. And she, I guess, eventually learned how to type. I actually never read the book, but I don't have this quote. And wrote books and was a great educator, right? Quite a phenomenal story. So Helen Keller writes, someone was drawing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over my hand, she spelled into the other word, water. First slowly, then rapidly. I stood still, my whole attention fixed upon the motion of her fingers. Suddenly, I felt a misty consciousness as something forgotten, and someone A misty conscience is as something forgotten. And somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that water meant the wonderful, cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened in my soul, gave it light, hope, and set it free. Power of words. Words are amazing. So we can use the mental noting as an aid to Vipassana practice. You never want to confuse the word for the experience you're having. But the word, the name, the label, the mental noting, is kind of like you're framing the experience so you can really be there for that experience directly. Or it's a finger pointing to the experience. It said that 95% of the practice is this nonverbal sensing and feeling of what the experience is. And 5% is the pointing, is the naming. What will happen as you do this is sometimes the mental noting will become mechanical and will become 95% of what you're doing. And you have to be alert to that happening and then know how to make it more alive again. Stop letting being mechanical and automatic and stop letting it be the main thing you're doing. And just a very subtle little corner of your mind that's pointing your attention to the present moment. For some people, the mental noting simply doesn't work ever. It just doesn't, their mind doesn't help them in their meditation. You shouldn't feel obligated to do it. However, the statistics are in favor of mental noting. Joseph Goldstein once said that he saw in many students that he taught that the ones who used mental noting as part of their Vipassana practice tended to make faster progress than the ones that don't. That's only statistic, right? You might be the exception, who makes super fast progress without mental noting. I mean, there are such people, right? So you have to... This mental noting is a skillful means. It's an aid that's suitable for some people and not for others. Suitable for some people sometimes. Some people find it very useful to note when they first sit down, as a way of getting warmed up and the way of kind of helping them disentangle from their thoughts. And then they let go when the mind gets quieter. Some people find that to note only certain things, as I said, thoughts or emotions. Some people find it's mostly useful to note when the mind is very, very quiet and concentrated and subtle, that's actually when the noting is most powerful. It's an art form, and you might experiment with it. But don't assume that it doesn't work for you because you've tried it for 10 minutes and it seems like you're just getting more agitated. It's kind of like learning a bicycle. You have to give it some time to see if you can kind of master it so it becomes second nature and helpful. So any questions about that? Or Desha?
When I'm labeling or noting, I usually just use the word thinking. Are you suggesting I should label it more precisely?
You can. If it's obvious, then you can label it more precisely, remembering, planning, or something. So if you're a planner, if you spend a lot of time planning and meditation, after a while, probably you start noticing that. And then it's easy just, planning. You don't particularly want to spend time thinking about what is the exact word for this kind of thinking. You don't want to get busy. It's just 5%, just very simple kind of noting. Unless you're so caught up in your thoughts, just over and over and over again, you're just hardly ever present, just thoughts, just kind of... Then you might begin investigating a little bit, even with thoughts, analytically. What is it I'm thinking about? And start kind of finding more exactly what's the nature of the kind of thinking you have. But mostly just do what's obvious. But if it's obvious enough to be more precise than thinking, you might find it helpful. Yes?
So you mentioned earlier that when you know the negative thing like suffering or anger, that usually goes away. How about if you name a positive thing like joy? Would that go away too?
What would you like my answer to be?
I'm curious if it doesn't go away.
Yeah. There's Oh, yes. The question is, I said earlier that if you note something like anger or pain or something, it goes away. Depression, it goes away. But what about if you note positive things, you know, joy or something? Will it go away or will it stay? Will it get stronger? What happens? There is a general overall tendency, seems like almost like a spiritual rule of psychology, that when you are clearly aware of what's happening, that tends to promote the wholesome states of mind. And it tends to decrease the unwholesome states of mind. However, that's a general trend. In any given moment, it might not be so linear. And so sometimes bringing greater awareness to your anger might actually lend itself to rage being released. It's like you suddenly touch the tip of the iceberg and you brought your attention to it more carefully and you realize the iceberg is huge. And then you get really angry, so it's gotten stronger rather than going away. And sometimes the joy you might be feeling might be very ephemeral and might actually not, you know, just noting it, bringing attention to it, it might actually disappear very quickly. Some pleasure that you might have. So, you know, you can't make it, it's not always, you know, some direction it goes. Sometimes it's said that you can expect one of three things to happen to your experience when you're mindful of it. It can get stronger, it can get weaker, and it can stay the same. And it's not your responsibility, and it's not your job to prefer one over the other, or to expect one over the other, or want one over the other, no matter what the experience is. As a meditator, your job is simply to be aware of how it goes. Oh, look at this. It's getting stronger. Look at this. I have this pain. It's watching it. Wow, this is fascinating. It's getting stronger. Look at that. Amazing. I feel like my leg's going to fall off. Wow, that is interesting. I wonder how much pain a single person can stand. Wow, that is interesting. Or, you know, another time you notice the pain and say, oh, look at that. Amazing, it disappeared. I was just going to pay attention to it, and I was getting interested in pain, you know, to investigate it, and it just went away like that. You know, that's too bad. Oh, well. You know.
So if it gets more as you note it, do you just keep noting it?
Yeah. And then you might notice if your notes are getting faster, more frantic. Pain. You know, the idea is the notes can help you stay balanced and calm. You know, if you note in a calm way, maybe you stay calm. And
you mentioned something about progress in meditation.
Yeah. Nine o'clock. I remember the whole issue of progress is, it's a huge topic. Should I talk about it next Monday? That's what happened. I remember some years ago. This is what happened. I used the P word, and someone asked that, you know, and then the following week I came and gave a talk about progress. And so maybe next week I'll try to talk about progress. If I'm here, you realize that, probably most of you realize that my wife's about to have a baby, and it could be literally any, you know, minute, any day now. Her due date is October 25th, but she feels like it's... like, you know, it's, baby is sitting down there deep in her pelvis pushing. And so may you all make lots of progress.